So we started this hour talking about fermentation, which at the molecular level is all about the microbes. Well, in science labs around the country, there's another revolution brewing, the discovery and exploration of a new frontier, the microbiome. One of the stars in this field is Rob Knight. He's a native of New Zealand who now runs a lab at the University of California, San Diego, and Steve Paulson caught up with him.
Rob, some people talk about the microbes in our body as our second genome, in some ways just as important as our genetic makeup. Why are microbes so important?
They're so important because there's a lot of them, and they also have a tremendous amount of diversity. We're composed of about 20,000 human genes and about 10 trillion human cells. But we can have as many as 100 trillion microbial cells, outnumbering us by as many as 10 to 1, and potentially several million microbial genes. So there's really a lot of things that they're doing that we wouldn't be able to do without them.
So I just want to put these numbers in perspective that you just mentioned. 10% of the cells in our body are human. I mean, only 10%, which means 90% are actually bacteria?
That's exactly right. In terms of numbers, they're really the dominant player in the system. When it comes down to it, we're all 99.99% the same in terms of our human genome, but we can be 80 or 90% different in terms of those microbial genomes.
Are you saying there is great diversity among different human populations? We might have totally different microbial environments in our bodies?
Not just between human populations, but even among people living in the same household. Although you're more similar to the people that you live with, and even to the dogs that you live with, even a pair of identical twins still have very different microbial communities.
Now, I've read that you have taken this very seriously in your own family. When you and your wife had a young baby, your daughter, you were taking regular swabs of her diapers, is that right?
My partner and I have been tracking our daughter's microbes from very early on, actually. And I can tell you from personal experience that I can really see why people don't in general either sign up for these studies or stick to these studies, right? Because, you know, if it's 3 a.m. and you just got up at 1 a.m. to feed or change the baby last, and, you know, you have a fresh sample in hand and you have to do something with it, it's really difficult to build up the motivation to actually go out to the garage and stick it in the freezer.
Wait, you're saying that every time you would change a diaper, you would take a swab?
We were almost that motivated, but not quite. So what we actually did was we took the whole diapers, stuck them in the freezer. Then regrettably, the job of actually extracting the fecal material from the diapers fell to some of the people in my lab. But yeah, in essence, that's what we've been doing. And then more recently, as she's got older, so she's a little over two now, we've been scooping it out and saving the scoop in the screw cap tube and so on. But yeah, the goal has really been to collect a complete record.
Well, in terms of this emerging science of the microbiome, your daughter must be among the most studied people in the world.
Well, I know of some other long-term time series like that, including people, researchers who've been collecting their own stool samples over a period of at least a decade. So despite this fairly large level of effort, I'm not necessarily sure that she would take the record of the most sampled person on Earth, although there's certainly a relatively small club that she belongs to in that respect.
Now, I know there are some scientists who talk about the Western microbiome. The idea is that the particular microbial environment that we Americans or Europeans tend to share, I mean, we who live in cities, is actually very different than more rural populations, especially in other parts of the world, say in Africa or Asia, and that perhaps for various reasons, the Western diet, other things, that our microbial system is not as healthy as it should be.
Yes, so it's certainly true that it's very different from what we see in non-Western populations. So, for example, we did a study, again, with Jeff Gordon's group, looking at people in the U.S. versus an African population in Malawi and an Amerindian population in Venezuela. What we found was that the U.S. population was very different from the other two in terms of the gut microbes.
So now, the suggestion is that certain chronic disorders that you especially find in more modernized environments, for instance, asthma, various allergies, perhaps type 2 diabetes, that they might actually result, at least partly, because of these depleted microbial systems.
Yes, exactly. And not just the ones that you listed, but also I'll say things like many forms of cancer, cardiovascular disease, even psychological illnesses such as depression, a lot of evidence that they have an inflammatory component, so the immune system is involved, and potentially a microbial component. So essentially what's known is that Western populations have different microbes. They have higher incidences of a lot of these diseases that involve the immune system. And then additionally, if you look at the people who have those diseases, for example, diabetics versus healthy controls, even obese people versus lean people. So, for example, we can tell if someone's lean or obese with 90% accuracy by looking at their gut microbes.
And given all of these changes and given what we're starting to learn, can we alter our microbial community in our own bodies?
Well, we can certainly alter our microbes in a number of ways. So we know that diet alters them, not so much in the short term, but over the long term, like over the course of a year, what diet you have seems to have a relatively large effect on your microbial community. You can alter them by travel, especially if you travel to the sorts of countries where you're likely to pick up a GI illness. You can alter them by antibiotics. Fecal microbiota transplant, for example, for Clostridium difficile-associated disease.
Wait, you're going to have to explain this. Fecal transplants?
Yeah, fecal transplants. Well, so I'm not sure how much explanation you need. You have someone who's sick, and you have someone who's healthy, and you want to take the feces from the healthy person and use it to put microbes into the sick person. So there's basically two directions that you can go in from. What Mike Sadowski at the University of Minnesota calls the northern or the southern route. Either of those options has been shown to be very effective for the diarrhea caused by this organism, Clostridium difficile. So this can persist for years where people are going to the bathroom, say, 15, 20 times a day. 90% of the time, they can be cured by taking the microbes from someone who's healthy and then doing that fecal transplantation to restore their gut microbial community. Now, you'll notice I didn't mention probiotics in terms of changing your microbiome.
Right, so which is, of course, the hot thing in a lot of health food stores in particular.
Right, exactly. So the studies that have been done to date suggest that probiotics don't have a large effect on your microbiome per se. So what the probiotics do, however, is they tend to change gene expression and the rest of the bacteria that are left behind. And so the effect that they're having is more in regulating the function of the microbes that you already have rather than in changing that microbial composition itself.
I want to go back to something that you said earlier, that even in the same family, even among identical twins, that the microbes are often extremely different. Why would that be?
Well, there's a lot of possible reasons. So one possibility is that the community assembly might be stochastic. So that's basically just a fancy way of saying that whatever microbe you're randomly exposed to first, maybe that affects what microbe can come in second, what microbe can come in third, and so forth. And so you might get very different communities developing just according to the sequence of microbes that you happen to be exposed to. So a second possibility is, you know, even for identical twins, there's all sorts of small differences in the environment, whether it's early on, one twin gets a hold of some dirt and eats it while the other one doesn't, or later on where, you know, maybe one eats a meal they shouldn't have, or one gets an accident and has to take antibiotics while the other doesn't.
You're saying so, even single incidents can change the microbiome that much?
Yes. So Dave Relman at Stanford has a fascinating study where he took three people, gave them the same antibiotic, and then looked at what happened. One person came back to their initial state more or less within a few weeks. The second person came back to that state within a few months. And the third person was still remarkably different, even I think it was about a year later. So on the one hand, the sample size was only three, so it's difficult to generalize. But on the other hand, there were different effects in all three people.
One final question. It seems that there is a larger philosophical question here as well. If 90% of the cells in my body are not actually human, that they are bacteria, then who am I? Do you think about that kind of thing?
Well, I do think about that kind of thing, as do a lot of people who are interested in bioethics and philosophy of science at the moment. And as with anything in philosophy, I think it's a question that we'll be arguing about for decades, if not for centuries or millennia to come.
Rob Knight is a microbial ecologist at the University of Colorado. He talked with Steve Paulson.